And we walk and we chant, this is our city. Это наш город. I had never felt before that this is my city. And, you know, for when we were protesting like that, we could feel that finally we are like, this is our home. And we want to live here the way we want to live here. You know, stop telling us how to be at home here.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Art Persist podcast, a series by Bosler Arts offering a glimpse into the life of artists and activists from all over the world, here to share their stories with you, the listener. My name's Georgia, and in this week's episode, we speak to Belarusian poet and activist Hannah Komar. I'll introduce Hannah properly in a second. But this is just a heads up for listeners that within this episode, we speak about quite upsetting themes of domestic violence, of imprisonment, and of torture. So if it's not the episode for you, don't worry. We'll be back next week with another one. I talked to Hannah about her life growing up in Belarus and how she really found poetry as a way of escape. We go on to talk about the 2020 elections in Belarus, which saw President Lukashenko seize power yet again and initiate a devastatingly brutal crackdown against the Belarusian people.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Art Persist podcast. I'm so excited to say that today's guest is Hannah Komar. Hannah is a Belarusian poet, translator, and writer. Her poetic work lays bare the experience of being a girl, then a young woman, growing up in a strongly patriarchal, authoritarian country. She's published 5 poetry collections, including Fear of Heights, a collection of documentary poetry, Will Return, Set Me Free or Run, as well as bilingual collections, Recycled and Rebought, and a non-fiction book, When I'm Out of Here. Hannah has an MA in creative writing from the University of Westminster and is currently doing her PhD at the University of Brighton, exploring how poetry can support Belarusian women to share experiences of gender-based violence and patriarchy. Hannah Komar, welcome to the Art Persist podcast.
Hello, Georgia. Thanks for introducing me.
My first question for you today is just, how are you? How are you feeling? How is your day going? How's your summer going?
We're in a very beautiful place, a very beautiful part of London. And it's a rainy day, but I feel calm and grounded.
Yes, very, very good. Well, Hannah, you've got a lot of really exciting things coming up, and I'm so excited to talk to you more about your life and your career. But I wanted to start by asking you to tell us a bit about your early life. Where did you grow up, and what was life like for you as a young child?
I grew up in a town called Baranovichi in the west of Belarus. It's between Brest and Minsk. In a very simple family. My parents are both working class people, you can say. Just like everyone went to school. I love to read as most or probably as all writers do. And from reading, I guess, my writing started.
Yeah.
I also danced as a child. So that maybe actually, and I always loved, I loved music and dancing. And my mom actually sent me to a choreography class because whenever I heard music, I start dancing, start moving. And I think that maybe it's connected with poetry as well, because, you know, for poetry, you need a sense of rhythm, pace, and poetry is music as well.
When did you get into poetry? Were you writing poems as a young child, or did it come later in your life?
I was reading a lot, but as a child, I don't think I was reading a lot of poetry. But I was reading lots of books, and sometimes not for my age, just whatever I could find it in our home library. In post-Soviet homes, you know, people had this home libraries, which were pretty much the same in many flats because... in the Soviet Union, you could get particular books, and it was kind of trendy to like collect them. So I would, when I was primary school, I would read Lermontov, who is a very serious writer and poet, very dramatic. Like, I obviously had no clue what he was talking about. Mm. But before I even could read, my grandmother taught me one of his poems by heart. Mm. So I couldn't read, but I could recite this poem by heart. Yeah. It's called A Sail. And it's very dramatic, but I still remember it. And maybe that also was like a start, an inspiration. And then I was 13 when my first poem happened. And I call it Happen because inspiration, I think it happens. It just suddenly comes to you and it overwhelms you and it overflows you. And suddenly you have something coming through you that you have no control over. Mm. And my first poem was dedicated to a friend of mine, my classmate, one of my closest friends at that time. And since then I was writing a lot. And poetry helped me survive, I think, stay sane. Because I lived in they call it now a dysfunctional family.
Yeah.
But basically I lived in almost everyday domestic abuse, physical, psychological, domestic abuse. Nobody talked to me about it, as it often happens in the family. Everybody knows something's going on. Everybody knows it's wrong. Mm. But no, it doesn't occur to people that you need to talk to your children about it, right? And help them deal with it. Mm. Because often the adults themselves cannot deal with it, right? And they are not aware, they're not conscious enough, they don't have the tools. So I found my own tools. Poetry was helping me because I was like, teenagers do have this difficult a couple of years, right?
Yeah.
Often you can get like suicidal thoughts, you feel lonely, neglected, just desperate, basically.
Yeah.
And so I was writing it all out, all those dark feelings. I was writing them out in the poems, and I recently found my poems from when I was 13, 14, 15, 16.
I was just going to ask if you had still had them.
It's overwhelming. There's so much desperation, so much of this, like, this life will never be good, basically, you know, it would always be so bad.
Yeah.
And but then I could also trace how I was transforming, how it was actually getting better.
Yeah.
You know, and poetry does have the power, transformational power, through, because it's a conversation, right? First, it was a conversation with myself, but it helped me to actually be honest with myself, to kind of validate to myself my own feelings before I could talk about it to someone else. Mm. And that wasn't until I actually grew up.
Yeah. And while you were writing these poems, I guess as a form of kind of escape, perhaps as well from the situation, were you still reading? Were there any poets that you were reading that you felt resonated with you as well?
As a teenager, I loved Marina Tsvetaeva's poetry. Mm. She was a Russian poet of this Serebryny Vek. What's called? What is it called in English? Silver Age of Russian literature.
Okay.
And she was very powerful. She was a rebel.
Mm.
And she had a non-conventional life and she was extremely talented. She published her first book when she was 13 and it was...
Wow.
It was fantastic poetry. It was a grown-up poetry. It was very talented. I think she was a genius, actually. And she was like this, and the ocean wave, you know, like tsunami. Mm. And but a lot of drama as well, you know. And so I loved her poems. Mm. I didn't read much Belarusian literature, though, surprisingly, because... Mm. Sadly, what we were taught at school didn't resonate much with me. It was like about village life, those like times which I could not understand what they're writing about, classics. I'm not too much into classics in any language somehow. So Marina Tsvetaeva actually affected me a lot. And then also, but you know what? Still, she was the 20th century Russian poet.
Mm.
And I was living in the, then already 21st century Baranovici, yeah. Belarus. So I needed to find something that would talk to my present day experience, yeah, to me here and now. Mm. And we had this newspaper for teenagers and, mm-hmm, and young adults. And they had a section where they published poetry and prose poetry, mm, written by people like me.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, children, mm, you can say, who would submit things to them. And it was extremely interesting. Mm. You know, it was so, some of it was, I think, revolutionary. I had never read anything like that in school books. Yeah, in this like Russian and Belarusian literature that we read at school, etc., mm, or that I could find in the library. And I think it also shaped me. It just showed me that there is a different way to write, which is, you know, different from this classical, traditional, yes, way.
Amazing. And so you're a teenager and you're starting to write poetry. At what point did you leave home? And what point did you leave home, and where did you go when you did?
I did leave home when I was 18, mm-hmm, as most of us did. I went to study, mm-hmm, to do my undergrad in Minsk, the capital of Belarus.
Yeah.
I studied at Minsk State Linguistic University. Mm-hmm. I studied English language, English and German, actually. I'm a teacher of English and German by education. Mm-hmm. My first education. And in those years, I was actually writing in Russian. Mm-hmm. I started writing in Russian because my entire environment was Russian speaking.
Yeah.
And the family, etc. And then, and already I think when I graduated from the uni and I was working at school as a teacher of English, I met a group of people. I got into this like non-formal educational platform, mm, called Belarusian Collegium. And they had a course in literature and philosophy, mm-hmm, but it was non-formal education, which means it was taught by all these incredible Belarusian writers, poets, philosophers, intellectuals. And that was a whole new universe that I was completely unaware of, mm, before. And it was all in Belarusian. So, mm, I slowly started speaking Belarusian, and I shifted to writing in Belarusian.
Wow.
And I even remember having this gap of not being able to write at all because I didn't want to write in Russian anymore, because, yeah, suddenly I knew this is not my language.
Yes.
And I couldn't write in Belarusian because it's like, we actually learn it as a foreign language, sadly, you know. Mm. You learn it at school, but because there is no language environment, mm, it's almost like a foreign language. And I basically lacked vocabulary.
Wow.
So it took me time. But then I, thanks to not having vocabulary, I changed like from this traditional rhyming form to free verse, mm, which made my poems better, I believe. And actually the things I wrote about changed.
Yeah.
It also kind of coincided with me going into therapy, and, mm, it was such an interesting combination. And I think I got access to some of, to those like areas and dark corners of the subconscious that I didn't have access to in Russian, because language can do that.
Yeah. Amazing. Do you have a poem you think you want to recite to us?
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, whenever you're ready.
Yeah. This poem I wrote about my parents, because a lot of my poems are a way to process my relationship with my parents and, mm, my childhood trauma. And I don't feel this anymore the way I felt when I wrote this poem, because it was like maybe 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's still relevant because some people still go through this.
Yeah.
And I believe that poetry can give you the validation to know nothing's wrong with you and this is how you feel.
Mm.
And you need this to actually feel better, to overcome this. It's called To Unify. Do this. Come for a visit. Sit in front of them, say, I need to talk to you, and start crying. Cry for everything they haven't been for you. Cry that they never grew up and didn't protect you from themselves, that you still can't lean on them. That staring out the window is more amusing than being in their space. I'm so just like you, sounds sick. Cry that escaping from them, you throw yourself into the wrong arms, for anxiety wakes up before you and sings. Sleep, baby. It's so scary and so unsafe out there. You won't make it on your own. Don't even think you can. Find someone to cling to adhere and get attached to. Let him carry the responsibility for your happiness. You can stay a little girl a while longer. Cry steadily, chokingly, take no breaks. You don't want to give them time to disagree. It's okay if they don't understand. It's fine, they're confused. Exchanging glances and sharing guilty silence. If all you have accomplished on your own cannot unite them, maybe guilt will.
Wow, that is an amazing poem. How does it feel to
recite it? Poor parents.
Have they ever heard your poem? Have they heard this poem?
I don't think they have heard this. I hope they won't. I don't want to upset them.
Yeah.
You know, my mom read some of my poems. Mm. I read some of my poems for her back when I was living in Belarus. And and she's funny. And I would read these philosophical poems for her. And she's like, well, I don't really understand them. Can you read me something about love? This is universal, you know. Love is what my mom can understand, love poems.
Yeah. Wow. And how does it feel reading that poem back 4 years later? I mean, you mentioned that it's you don't resonate with it that much anymore, but do you reflect on the person that you were when you wrote it?
I do reflect. I'm happy that I'm past it.
Yeah.
This reading this poem just helps me see what a journey it's been for me.
Yes.
How I've transformed, how I've changed. Mm. Yes. And it's incredible. It's like, you know, just seeing who I was, what I was and what I'm like now.
Absolutely. And Hannah, apart from all of this kind of self-transformation that you went through, which is really huge and heavy as well. I mean, you've been through a lot personally. This other part of your life came, which is the political side of Belarus. And in August 2020, Belarus had presidential elections, which saw the president, Alexander Lukashenko, who has been president since 1994, be re-elected in what was clearly fraudulent elections. And it has led to led to widespread protests, mass protests in the country, but also an incredibly brutal crackdown by the president. Could you maybe start by telling us a little bit about, you know, before August 2020, what the situation was in Belarus and how the presence of a kind of authoritarian ruler, how that felt and it shaped people's lives on a kind of daily basis?
Dictatorship is closely connected with patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they really walk hand in hand. And it's always about violence.
Mm.
And all violence is the same violence, you know, be it making, like persuading people that they're only this and not that, that a man should go to work and earn money and then come home and watch TV, and the woman should go to work, cook, clean, look after the children and be pretty. That's the, you know, the stereotype or the image that's kind of popularized in Belarus.
Yeah.
But violence and domestic violence is actually encouraged. It's not that it's not condemned, it's encouraged at the governmental level.
Mm.
In 2000, like the level of domestic abuse in Belarus is really high.
Yeah.
And it's obviously become worse because earlier women could at least call the police. Now they're afraid to call the police because they might have participated in the protests.
Yeah.
And when the police come, their husbands may report on them and they'll be jailed actually instead of their husbands who are abusers.
Mm.
And every third woman or a second woman in Belarus is, you know, has a fear of sexual or any other form of violence.
Yeah.
And we don't have the law protecting people.
Mm.
regardless of gender.
Yeah.
People, women, men, children, older people from domestic violence. And the Belarusian feminists, they had been working hard to promote that law. Mm-hmm. And they were working together with some governmental institutions like the Ministry of Internal Affairs, which is basically police structure. And they were cooperating. And then in 2018, Lukashenko said no.
Mm.
Just with just one person, just crossed out all the efforts for that. Yeah, that many, many like people and groups had been taken for years to develop this law. And he said, well, I beat my son sometimes. There's nothing wrong with that.
Oh my God.
And the way he communicates even with his... with the people who work for him.
Mm.
Or when he comes to a kolkhoz, you know, kolkhoz is a collective farm, and a lot of this is a rudiment from the Soviet system. When he comes, because he sees himself as this, he calls himself, or people were calling him Batyka. Batyka is Belarusian for father.
Okay.
So he considers himself the father of the nation.
The nation.
The patriarch.
Mm.
And so when he would come to this, like very often to these collective farms, and he would tell everybody off and he would show his power, and he would talk to people rudely and threaten them, you know, for like little mistakes or for little faults. You know, it's never him who is the problem, never the system who is the problem. It's always someone. And he uses quite brutal expressions like, I'm going to screw your head off, or you'll... like really rough, you know?
Yeah, violent language.
Yeah, the language that uses this, it's violent language basically, right? And there are a lot of those examples.
Mm.
Hi, this is Hossam Fazula, co-founder of Bosla Arts. The Artists podcast is independently run by Bosla Arts, me and Georgia, which allows us to share these important conversations with artists and activists from all over the world. In order to keep having these conversations, we need your help. Join us on Patreon for as little as £3 and help us continue this vital work. More info in the episode description. Now back to the podcast.
I guess the next thing to ask you would really be about that election and what the atmosphere was like before and how that changed after. And if you could just maybe paint us a picture of your own experience of that very, I guess, upsetting time.
Mm, yeah. So I was becoming more and more political. Mm. I used to actually separate politics. I used to call myself like a cultural dissident.
Mm.
Yeah. I was doing the cultural protest and I thought it was separate from politics. Because again, in Belarus, they stigmatized politics and being involved in politics as something that you don't want to be, do that. You're kind of suspicious, you know, or it's a dirty business, you know. So I was like, no, I don't want to participate. I'm a cultural dissident here. And in 2020, I was already working for PEN, and that was making me see a lot of things that I hadn't seen before, realize how actually culture, to see even more the potential we have.
Yes. Is this PEN Belarus?
PEN Belarus.
PEN Belarus, okay.
PEN Belarus. How much potential we have in terms of, let's just say, literature and culture.
Yeah.
And how the state, it didn't just support us, it prevented us from developing that potential.
Yeah.
And it made Belarusian culture look like kolkhoz, look very old-fashioned, unattractive for younger generations, something you just don't want to be associated with.
Yeah.
And then we had our kind of non-official Belarusian culture, non-official Belarusian literature. At some point, we called it Belarusian, our ghetto, because we were actually kind of ghettoized, you know, doing our little events in our Belarusian language, man, or a small group of small audiences, because we didn't have access to the TV, state TV, we didn't have access to state radio, or just to this like media and channels through which we could spread the information about us. So that was the situation, and the language, obviously. Yeah, yeah. We couldn't. Yeah, the Russian language was dominating and encouraged, and Belarusian was discouraged. Mm. And also, you'd look suspicious if you spoke Belarusian, because you're either a political opposition, which is you don't want to be that.
Yes.
Or you're from a village, which is stigmatized as well.
Okay.
And in 2020, Lukashenko had already been in power for 26 years. Yeah. And we saw this was just going to be another presidential election that was not going to change anything. Like every single election before that, regardless of the like political protest that followed the elections. But suddenly this time was different, because suddenly they appeared several alternative candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, how well? It was very unexpected.
Yeah.
But they were different, and they managed to kind of trigger different groups of society, different layers of society. But in the end, they woke us up.
Yeah.
And it turned out that there were lots of people who wanted change. Mm. Lots of people who knew it was wrong. Lots of people who wanted a better life.
Mm.
And lots of people who wanted to live in a free country and finally have a different government to at least try to see what it's like, you know. Mm. So lots of people joined that movement. First, we supported alternative candidates. Then it was the election, the outrageously rigged results, 82%. If he had said 60, we would be like, okay. Whatever, maybe it is. Maybe there are a lot of stupid people living in Belarus, ignorant, who really voted for him. But it was 82, and there was no way it was 82, because there was a huge campaign it started with campaign of independent observers.
Mm.
So the focus was on using legal tools and law and our legal rights. So you go to the polling station as an independent observer, and there was a network. People volunteered to be those independent observers. And to be an independent observer, you had to collect signatures from your neighbors. Mm. So people started to get to know each other. Oh. And people realized, oh, wow, we are many, and we're sharing the views, and we are like sharing the mood. And so basically on the election day, there were lots of people, just regular people at the polling stations or outside polling station, because we were not even let in there.
Oh, wow.
Because we were supposed to make sure that the election was fair, that it was done by law, everything was transparent. So we were not even let in the room, the like voting rooms. But our symbol was a white bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also an independent observer sitting outside the polling station. And so in Minsk it was. And with my own eyes, I saw all these people with white bracelets. And if they didn't have a white bracelet, they would come up to me and say, I don't have a bracelet, but I'm with you. Or there was a woman, that was the most touching moment. She came up to me and she asked me, are you an independent observer? I said, yes. And then she was like, can I give you a chocolate? And I was like, sure. And then like, can I hug you?
Mm.
And we hugged, and she said, we're going to make it, right?
Mm.
And looked into my eyes with such a huge hope. We all had our hope, and I believe that we would make it this time.
So it sounds like at this point, kind of hope has regained the consciousness of people. You know, the status quo has been broken, and for the first time, people think, actually, we can make a change. Things can change.
We are in power, because what we were made to believe is that we are powerless, that we cannot change anything.
Yeah.
And it was just such a game changer, even to believe, to have a little idea, to have a little glimpse of that we can change. Mm. And that evening after the election, you know, when I was returning from this, and then, you know, the independent observers were arrested.
Mm.
And it was a chaos. You could tell it was all such a mess. Like, they were among the riot police. They came to the polling stations. They would escort workers from the people who were working at the polling stations. They were taking out the bags with our ballot papers.
Wow.
It was crazy. It was so obvious. And it was happening not just Minsk. It was happening all around the country. So everybody, like all those people could see what was happening, you know? Yeah. So you couldn't tell us anymore, oh, you're inventing. No, because we saw it with our own eyes. Mm. And that evening, the night after the voting ended, and I think somehow this like preliminary results were announced pretty early. And it was obviously fake. And but people took to the streets just, you know, to say, look, this is bullshit. We disagree. Yeah. We know this is wrong. This is not true. Come on. And I remember coming to the, I thought I would go home tonight and on Monday I'll go to protest. And I come to this crossroads. It's Masharov Avenue. It's a very wide avenue from it, like for cars and buses and trams. And it was not far from, I knew that already there were like stun grenades used against people in tear gas. And my friends were already running away from all that.
Yeah.
Very close from there because it's a city center. And so I come to this crossroad and there are people standing on the side of the road and just making a decision whether they want to go on the road or not. And then they decide that we want to go on the road. And I'm like, of course, then I'm carried together with this mass of people. We are all exhilarated, euphoric. We walk on this like wide avenue, you know, everything stop, car stop, tram stop. And we walk and we chant, this is our city. Это наш город. I had never felt before that this is my city. And, you know, for when we were protesting like that, we could feel that finally we are like, this is our home and we want to live here the way we want to live here, you know, stop telling us how to be at home here.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that, first of all. And it obviously sounds like such a massive moment for your life and the lives of everyone around you. When did it start to turn really ugly? Obviously, the Lukashenko, during the protests, started a campaign of mass crackdown. Maybe you can remind me of the number of political prisoners still in prison in Belarus. I think the last time I checked was 1,400, perhaps.
That's just officially.
Okay.
By, according to the Human Rights Center, Vesna. But there are other numbers, which is over 1,500.
Okay.
But we all know that's the minimum we are aware. A lot of people, we just don't know that they are political prisoners.
Yeah.
And some people are imprisoned under different non-political articles.
Yes.
So you cannot even identify them. A lot of people, their families are worried. They don't want to report them as political prisoners. Some people don't have relatives and friends. Some people are completely alone there. So, you know, in reality, there are probably like 5,000 political prisoners in Belarus. And they released some, like the other day, Lukashenko pardoned, quotation marks, 30 people, but every day more people are arrested and jailed.
Yeah.
So it just looks like liberalization, but it's not. And it started getting ugly from the very beginning, actually, from the first night, the 9th of August, after the election. The 9th, 10th, and 11th of August, we had this night protest. So we would go out, take to the streets at night. In those three nights, and probably on the 12th as well, but especially on the first three nights, they arrested 6,000 to 7,000 people.
Wow.
And there is this infamous Akrestina prison in Minsk, where they kept people, 50 people in a cell for 8. It was hot.
Terrifying.
There was no air. There was no food. In the best scenario, there would be one bottle for water that you could fill in and pass around. Imagine just 50 people in a basically tiny room.
Yeah, hell. Torture, basically.
And they tortured people. They would beat them up. There would be blood everywhere. Women would hear these men screaming because they were tortured in the corridors, stripped naked. They were raped. Women were raped. Men were raped, like, with police batons. it was just unimaginable. And then on the 12th, they started, the women's women in white dresses took to the streets, demanding to stop this violence, to end the violence. And they started letting people out on the 13th, I think. And it was just unimaginable. They were bruised all over. People were bruised all over, just from head to toe. It was horrifying. And so when Belarusians saw this horrifying violence, you know, they just couldn't stay away. So while it started with the rigged election results, in the end, it was about the violence. And because though your neighbors, they were friends, friends of your friends, your relatives, everybody, it concerned started everyone.
And to see just the extent of which your, you know, the state would treat your own people for just a protest is, I imagine, is unbelievably upsetting to see and would ignite something.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And I actually have a poem, wrote a documentary poem about it. There was a girl, she was actually, she's from Russia, but she had a Belarusian boyfriend. And on the 9th of August at night, they went to the city center to see what's happening, you know. And as she shared that atmosphere was so like a celebration, you know, so full of hope. And so they came and they got into that brutality. And there is an interview she gave, a video interview. So I wrote a poem from basically her words. It's a super long poem. I'm not going to read it all. I'm just going to read. So she was, they both were arrested. And she spent 4 days in a Krestina. And she describes all the tortures they were going through. And I'll just read the ending of the poem. 38 of us. We didn't have anything. Just a scrape of toilet paper, a piece of soap, just a piece, a tiny piece. We spent a while sharing it. The toilet was a hole in the floor. On the third night, they brought us bread. On the fourth, they brought us oatmeal, bread, and tea. It was the most delicious food I ever had. Just some black tea and a slice of bread. 4 whole days, we took turns crying and we sang. In the middle of the night, they began to let us go. I saw how they were letting everyone go. I saw they let everyone go. I saw. I am a witness of that shared deep pain and happiness.
Thank you so much. That was absolutely beautiful. And Hannah, I know you yourself were also imprisoned and you now live in London out of Belarus. Could you maybe share, if you're comfortable to, a little bit about your own experience of being in prison?
I was arrested on the 8th of September 2020 for a peaceful protest when we went out to support Maria Kolesnikova, who was in prison just a day before that. And there were a lot of women with us and some men. And when the police encircled us and basically pressed us against the wall, there was just like the road on one side, the wall on the other side. And we went to the wall and they encircled us, we were blocked, and they said, give us the men and you go. And we're like, no way.
Wow.
You are very proud. We are proud women. Why? And also, who are you?
Yeah.
Why do you tell us what to do? What do you mean you want our? These are our men. We're not giving them to you. So we were like trying to hide them behind us, trying to resist. And they, in the end, they just ended up arresting us as well. So they, on that very night, they arrested about 100 women, or over 100 women, and some men as well. And that was the first, this like mass arrests of women, which was not on the first night. And they changed, like there was a game changer since then. After that, they started arresting women also in big amounts. And that was a pretty traumatic experience. It was just very anxious to be there because my biggest fear was to be raped because of, we know what happened. And because they were making these jokes, like when they brought us already to a different prison, from first we were in the Krestin, and then Jodzin is a different town, and there is a prison there as well, and they brought us there. It's like, you know, a midnight, there are four of us young women. We are standing faces to the wall. That's how you stand in prison, obviously. And there are two young guards, and their boss, a totally like crazy bipolar guy whose moods change like literally every half a minute.
Yeah.
And you never know. And then, so we're standing, and he asked these two young boys, like, they're really boys. We were waiting for an inspection. And this is what, so you come to prison, then they bring you, you have to dress down, take all the clothes down, have to squat, sit squat, and they check. It's very humiliating. So we're waiting for that procedure, and he asked them, oh, do you want to inspect these girls yourselves? And then he says, oh, no, better not, because they might like it.
Oh, God.
And then he's like, what are you looking? Choosing one for yourself. And then he says, well, promise you a discotheque on Friday. And like, my heart literally sank. Yeah. I thought, this is it. And I was just in my mind trying to figure out a strategy, how to behave, not to get in trouble, you know, how to be as like invisible, unattractive as like fuck, possible, you know, like just so unattractive that they wouldn't even look at me, which in prison is easy. and then, yeah, so I was released. The solidarity with me was so huge. I'm still like, I'm still grateful for it. I still remember it. And I wrote a book then. I was writing a little diary when I was there.
Yeah.
Because I thought, I'm a writer. I need to make sense of this experience. I can at least write about it. So I was writing a diary. It was difficult though. After that, I've been barely writing, to be honest. Like, my own things. And I also interviewed, inspired by Svetlana Alexievich, the Belarusian writer and Nobel laureate in literature from 2015. So I interviewed other people who were there with me in on the evening of the detention, then in jail, and my friends and family who were supporting us. Because I wanted to include everyone, you know, because very often we talk about people in jail, we don't talk about their families and friends. Yes. And so many more people. When one person is arrested, like dozens are affected. And I was so grateful. I wanted to memorialize, you know, this immense solidarity and support. And I, yeah, then I put together my diary and the interviews of those people into a book called Kalia Vidu na Volu, which is translated as When I'm Out of Here. And I'm translating it into English.
Amazing.
Hoping to get it published next year.
Wow, can't wait for that moment. It's incredibly, it's just an incredibly difficult experience that you went through, obviously. And I wanted to ask you, you just said that you know, you're not really writing as much now. And I was wondering how your experience of living outside of Belarus has been, and how it's kind of shaped you in the work that you're doing since.
For 3 years I refused to admit how much I miss home. I can't return because I'll definitely be jailed right after I cross the border. And I thought I was okay. Till recently I watched a documentary, The Accidental President, about Svetlana Tikhanovskaya and and our movement. And I saw one of the streets in Minsk where I would, when I was in my early 20s, and my boyfriend lived in that area. So with him and his friends, we would often go to that supermarket on the street to get like beers and snacks, you know. And it triggered me so much that I burst into tears. And this is when I knew how much I was missing home. And I've kept creating. Maybe I don't write my own. I say there is my own work and then there is documentary work because documentary or nonfiction is just not purely my work. It's a collaboration with lots of other people who share their stories with me so I can then make literature from them. So this is basically the only thing I've been able to do. And I'm writing a thesis, a PhD thesis, about where I focus on the connections between domestic abuse and state violence in Belarus and women's experiences of that. Mm. And I really feel here it's very hard to be heard and seen as a Belarusian. People don't know anything about Belarus. It's very hard to explain the importance of it, not just from a human point of view, but strategically as well.
Yeah.
And I almost feel like I have to become a historian. Mm. And I think that's one of the reasons poetry doesn't work for me anymore, because a poem can be a starting point. Mm. But then there are so many things I literally have to explain as if it was a history lesson.
Yes.
But even here, I meet a lot of, maybe I'm just lucky. I don't know. I know people with different experiences, but I have this bubble, or I make this bubble for myself, where a lot of people are understanding and they are supportive. Mm. And I've been invited to so many events to speak by different organizations, by individuals, to speak, to perform poetry, to talk about Belarus, to participate in panel discussions. Mm. You know, also try to, like, I'm in touch with the Belarusian community. I am part of the Belarusian community in London here. Yeah. We also organize events. It's hugely important for me, trying, like, to raise money or to raise awareness.
Yes.
And just keep people together.
Mm. And actually, I wanted to ask you, for those listeners who maybe don't know that much or want to kind of get involved, because I know there's a lot that can be done, especially for the prisoners in Belarus who are still incarcerated. What do you think is a good place for people to start if you want to show solidarity or even just learn more?
There are a number of media in English that you can read. They're Belarusian media that you can read in English.
Yeah.
So I would suggest finding them and reading, because this information will probably be more reliable than what you read here, because of the angle of the positionality, let's say. Also, there are a few websites of human rights organizations, such as Spring 96 and also Dissident Buy, who provide not just information and numbers, but they do provide information and numbers and statistics, but also the ways to support people, be it writing a letter or be it making a donation or spreading the information, or maybe cooperating in other ways. And then people can tell share this information about with their communities. Mm. They can organize their own solidarity events, and invite Belarusians to speak about them. There can be film screenings. Mm. It can be poetry readings. It can be like music evenings, anything. Or, I'm inviting the listeners in November. We are staging a play.
Yes.
My play is called Body in Progress, part of the Voila Festival. The Theatre Daily and the 8th and 9th of November, we are putting it on. And it basically tells about my experience of coming to London, suddenly having a severe PTSD, trying to reconnect the dissociated body and mind, missing home, having flashbacks to the prison experience, and basically dealing with the trauma, choosing not to be a victim of that experience.
And I cannot wait to see this play, and I'll make sure that I put links in the episode description. So if you're listening to this, please check it out, and I'll also share it on Bosla Arts.
Yeah, support Belarusian culture. It's amazing.
Yes, support it. Well, Hannah, this has been an incredibly powerful and deeply moving talk. I really thank you so much for joining us today. And I really look forward to seeing everything that you do in the next few years.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the space to share things about Belarus. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank Hannah Komar for joining us for this week's episode. As always, if you'd like to learn more about her work or even attend her play, you can find links in the episode description. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Artpersist podcast. As always, if you are enjoying the podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen, give us a rating, and share your favourite episode with friends and family. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode.